the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Well, good evening, everybody. If you're new to Belmont, I know there are at least two people who've never been here before this evening. It's really great to see you. My name is Derek Burnside. I'm one of the leadership team. And as you may have gathered, you're coming in at the end of a teaching series we're doing, looking at divorce and remarriage. And I thought it might just be useful, as we come to the end of this little short series, just to explain how this fits in to some wider thinking we're doing as a church. We're just coming to the close tonight of a Bible teaching series that looks at some of the key passages and themes around this topic. And the reason we're doing it is because we're beginning a process that's going to go throughout most of this year as a leadership team and as a wider church, where we're exploring our position on this. I may be corrected, but I think I'm right in saying that the last time Belmont remarried a divorcee was just before I arrived in the church, 1985, I think. I might be wrong. But it's a long time since this church has remarried a divorcee, regardless of the circumstances surrounding the divorce, by the way. And we wanted to just re-examine that position and just see whether that's the right thing biblically to be doing. If you don't know us, we're an evangelical church. Oh, slobs, go. There we go. They're gone. Good. That's sorted out the men from the boys, isn't it? Yeah. You're lucky people. They're all thinking. You lot are thinking. Oh, can I do slob? So it's a while since Belmont's remarried a divorcee, and we wanted to just, as a leadership team, explore that position. Is that a good reading of the scriptures? Should we be rethinking it? Should we be continuing in that process? And the way we're going to do it is this: we have started by teaching some of the key passages, and we're teaching them just to have a look at what the Bible says. And to look at varying interpretations that different Christians arrive at from these passages. And that finishes tonight. Then we're going to do this. By the end of March, we hope, that's what we're aiming for, a general paper is going to be produced outlining the various passages, interpretations, and applications. Again, that paper is going to try and do what this teaching series is doing, not arrive at any conclusions, but just explore the scriptures together. We're an evangelical church, and that means that we think Scripture is authoritative and reliable and useful for teaching and rebuking and correcting and training in righteousness. And what it teaches is going to be the basis of our behavior. So we're going to teach this series and then put a paper out that kind of expands on what we've said and maybe takes a little more time and space to look at what these passages actually say. Then there will be opportunities made available for reflection and prayer and comment and discussion. So we'll create space, hopefully in home groups, maybe on prayer Thursdays and perhaps other times, to pray specifically about this issue as a church. We're going to encourage one another to be reflecting personally on these issues. We will create opportunity, probably midweek in a non-house group week, for those that would like to come together and just discuss the issues informally in a way that we can't do so easily in a kind of sermon format. But hear an idea and throw something back and discuss and go back and forth and just chew on this together. Then the leadership team will produce a provisional position paper. When we've looked at the passages again, heard the views of the church, we're a church that believes that it's not just leaders who hear God. We are all equally able to listen to God speak to us by his word through his spirit. So it's not the leaders have a hotline. We want to see what we sense the spirit is saying to the whole church on this. So once we've had that reflection, prayer, commitment, discussion opportunity, then the leadership team will produce a provisional position paper, and there'll be another chance for the congregation to comment. The leadership team will go back and give it further thought, reflection, and prayer, and then by the end of the year, there'll be a final position paper outlining future practice. Okay, that's where we are. So we are right at the start of this process. And over the last few weeks, John started off by thinking about the biblical picture of marriage generally, and then Clive helped us think through pastoral care and the way that Scripture impacts pastoral care. If God's word is our best, then that will be the best thing to talk into one another's lives. But how do we do that? That was entitled, if you remember, Tough Minds But Tender Hearts. How do we fit those two things together? And then a couple of weeks ago, Ruth got into the passages themselves about divorce and remarriage in the Gospels, And my job tonight is to do that for Paul's teaching in the New Testament. And to do that, we're going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And you'll find that on page 1084 in the Bibles in front of you. I would really commend you to turn those up and follow this through. So we're going to read the whole of 1 Corinthians 7 in just a moment to get the thread of the teaching of this whole passage. It might help, before we do that, just to bear in mind the questions that it looks like Paul is answering. So we read these questions out of the answers he gives. We're hearing kind of one side of the conversation, but you'll see in verse 1 he says, "Now for the matters you wrote about." What are the matters he wrote that they wrote to him about, the Corinthians wrote to him about? And it looks like there are five. At least these are the five that I can see. The first one is this: should Christians be getting married at all? Now, that may seem a really weird question for us, but clearly it was an issue in the first century. Once we've come to Christ, does that somehow make marriage unnecessary or inappropriate? Should Christians be getting married? That's question one. Question two: in a culture as sexually immoral as first century Corinth, should Christians be having sex at all? Or is the whole sex thing just too dirty to be redeemable? That seems to be a question. And there seems to have been a pressure around this culture to say we should just stop having sex completely. Whether we're married or single, let's just cut sex out, because we see it abused so much in our culture. Question three: if a Corinthian is asking, if I have become a Christian, but before I was a Christian, I was married to a non-Christian, and the non-Christian hasn't become a Christian with me, is it still a marriage in God's sight? Is that still a legitimate marriage? If a Christian is married to a non-Christian, is that a legitimate marriage, or is it not actually a marriage in God's sight, and is it therefore unholy or adulterous? Question four: if a Christian being married to a non-Christian is unholy and adulterous, should the Christian leave the marriage? Should the Christian just desert and get out of that marriage? That seems to be question four. And question five was, what's the situation for a Christian who has had it the other way around? That they were married to a non-Christian, they become a Christian, the Christian's become a Christian, and the non-Christian partner has said, well, I'm not staying married to you if you're part of this weird cult. I'm leaving you. And they've gone. What's the position of the Christian who's been abandoned or deserted in that marriage? Should they still regard themselves as married? Should they fight for the marriage to be restored? Do they still have a responsibility somehow to see their unbelieving former spouse brought to faith? What's the deal with all that one? Those seem to be the questions that Paul answers. Should we see how he answers them? Let's read. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we're on page 1084. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband, and in the same way the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am, but each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another that gift. At the start of chapter, verse 7 there, he seems to be saying he wishes they were all single, as he is. Now, to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried, as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. And by that, he seems to mean there is teaching from Jesus that he's aware of, that he is basing this teaching on. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord, and by that he means there is not teaching from Jesus on this, but he's speaking to it with his apostolic authority, as he normally does. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer, and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer, and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? How do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Nevertheless, each of you should live as a believer in whatever situation the Lord has assigned to you, just as God has called you. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Each of you should remain in the situation you were in when God called you. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you, although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For those who are slaves when called to faith in the Lord are the Lord's freed people. Similarly, those who are free when called are Christ's slaves. You were bought at a price. Don't become slaves of human beings. Brothers and sisters, all of you, as responsible to God, should remain in the situation in which God called you. Now, about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who, by the Lord's mercy, is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think it's good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Don't look for a wife. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. If a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who are married should live as if they were not, those who mourn as if they did not, those who are happy as if they were not, those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep, those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them. For this world, in its present form, is passing away. I'd like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably towards the virgin he is engaged to, and she's getting beyond the usual age for marrying, and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He's not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who's under no compulsion, but has control over his own will, and who's made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who marries the virgin does right, but he who doesn't marry her does better. A woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes. But he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she's happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I too have the Spirit of God. Well, shall we see what we can make of this in the few moments that are left for us? And as you may gather, you will have had, I think, a million questions that pop up in your mind from one of these very difficult passages in the New Testament. I will not answer them all, I promise you. That's not going to happen. But I would love it if you want to come and say, that really bothered me and you didn't mention that afterwards, I'll do my best. But for the sake of time, we're going to focus particularly on the issues pertaining to divorce and remarriage. Now, there are two main interpretations of 1 Corinthians 7. And in the few minutes we have, I'm just going to try and explain them both. Here's interpretation one, and it goes like this. In a nutshell, somebody taking this line on 1 Corinthians 7 would say this. Paul says that divorce is occasionally inevitable, but that remarriage is never permissible. That would be one possible interpretation of this passage. And many scholars who will take this line will point to verses 10 and 11 and say it's one of the clearest statements on the impermissibility of remarriage after divorce that we find. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. And some scholars will simply look at that and go, that, well, the plain reading surely is clear. Interpretation one, we'll also want to be underlining other points that Paul makes in this passage. First is, as we pointed out as we read it through, Paul seems to be basing his teaching on the teaching of Jesus. That's what he means when he says to the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. And it looks like Paul is basing his teaching on what Jesus says, as we have it, in Mark 10, verses 11 and 12. That's one of the passages that Ruth looked at 2 weeks ago. Now, of course, 1 Corinthians was written in about 55 AD, and Mark's Gospel would have been written 60 to 65 AD, we think. So 1 Corinthians predates Mark's Gospel, but it looks like Paul had some version of Jesus' teaching on divorce at his disposal, even if it wasn't quite as the Gospels that we have now. But he's basing his teaching on the impermissibility of remarriage after divorce, according to Interpretation 1, on the teaching of Jesus. And that means, friends, that we really must make sure we have under our belts the stuff that Ruth took us through so helpfully two Sunday nights ago. And if you were here, she gave us this very helpful grid, and it looked at all the different kinds of interpretations that are possible from Jesus' teaching on divorce in the Gospels. Is remarriage possible? Never. Is it possible sometimes? Should remarriage after divorce be possible? Always. And it has things to do about what the meaning of the word that's often translated adultery in our Bibles is, porneia. Does that mean premarital sex? Does it mean adultery within sex? Within marriage, sorry. That's a big issue as you look at Jesus' teaching. Why does Matthew have a dispensation that Mark and Luke don't have for divorce for adultery, porneia, and so on? And Ruth covered it very helpfully. That talk is online. It's freely available just to download and listen to, and we commend it to you very thoroughly. You'll understand that I'm not going to go back over that material, but your interpretation of Jesus' teaching on divorce and remarriage will affect what you think Paul is saying here, inevitably, because Paul bases what he's saying on the teaching of Jesus. So this really is a two-part deal, and if you missed Ruth, you really should catch up with it. It was great stuff. So Interpretation 1 emphasizes it's based on the teaching of Jesus. Interpretation 1 also would say we have to listen to the value that Paul puts in 1 Corinthians 7 on singleness. So Paul says in verse 7 of 1 Corinthians 7, I wish that all of you were as I am. And he seems clearly to be saying, I wish all of you were unencumbered by marriage. Now, some scholars think Paul at some point in his life must have been married because he'd been a Pharisee, and Pharisees were normally married. And it might be that Paul himself is writing as somebody who has a failed marriage behind him, which is, I think, a pretty fascinating thought. But he's saying to those who are not married, I wish that all of you could be in the state that I am in. He seems to have a very, very high view of singleness. Verse 35, I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. And Interpretation 1, folks, would say, we cannot fully embrace the Bible's teaching on divorce and remarriage if we don't also fully embrace the Bible's teaching on singleness. Have you ever heard or maybe thought or even said yourself this kind of thing? How could Christians possibly say that it's not right to get remarried after you've been divorced? If a Christian says that, you are, and here's the phrase, you are condemning somebody to singleness for the rest of their lives. Have you ever heard that said or something like that? Or has that ever kind of escaped your lips? And that sense of singleness being something we are condemned to simply does not seem to figure in Paul's thinking. It would have figured in Jewish thinking, and Ruth pointed out 2 weeks ago that one of the things Jesus and Paul seem to be wanting to do is to correct this misunderstanding about singleness. This is a calling from God. He calls it in this chapter a gift from God. He says that the married person is unable to live with quite the same devotion to the Lord's kingdom work as a single person is. These are huge claims. And they are so countercultural for us, aren't they? In our culture, they are simply so countercultural. We live in a culture where the message is consistently the only way to fully live is in an exclusive romantic partnership. And if you're not in one of those, then somehow your life is incomplete. And the Bible will stand against that view of the incompleteness of singleness utterly. And it does have an impact on, I think, on our thinking and theology of remarriage after divorce. If we see singleness as some kind of wilderness that the divorced person is then condemned to for the rest of their life if they can't remarry, that will inevitably slant the way we think. And Paul will have, from 1 Corinthians 7, none of it. He emphasizes this thing too, called the present crisis, an interpretation one person will want to say. And if the scholars are honest, they don't really know what he means by that. What present crisis in Corinth? And from the context, I think the best we can say is this. Paul, when he's talking about the immorality in Corinth, that seems to be the crisis he's referring to. The NIV Study Bible describes the crisis as the pressures of living for Christ in an immoral and hostile environment. And that description will be applicable to huge numbers of cultures all around the world over the last 2,000 years. And if that's the criteria, you might actually want to say, an interpretation one person would say, that's a pretty good description of the crisis in which we live, sexually and maritally, in our culture at the moment. And in light of the present crisis, this seems to be Paul's heart. He says, let's not get engrossed in the things of this world. They are puzzling passages, I think, in the middle of this chapter, aren't they? This stuff about stay where you are. Don't seek to change. Whatever the situation you find yourself in, be content in it and stay there. I think those are puzzling verses. But I think what Paul is getting at is this. Don't get engrossed in the things of this world. Because in its present form, it's passing away. Live in undivided devotion to the Lord. If you get obsessed about getting married, Paul seems to be saying, then the whole this world of which marriage is a part, that's all passing away. He might have in mind Jesus saying, there will be no marriage in heaven. Why get so obsessed with something in this world that is passing when there is the Lord's work to do on this earth? That seems to be his main thrust of this argument in 1 Corinthians 7. Interpretation one, we'll also want to emphasize this. If abandoned, the deserted partner is not bound and is called to live in peace. Do you remember one of the questions was, if a Christian has been abandoned by a non-Christian partner, what should they do? Are they still married? Are they not married? How should they view the marriage? And this is Paul's answer. If abandoned, the deserted partner is not bound and is called to live in peace. And one of the great debates in this passage is, what does Paul mean by not bound? Does he mean not bound to the marriage, or does he mean free to remarry? What does he mean? That's the big question in 1 Corinthians 7 with regard to divorce and remarriage. And John Piper thinks he means this. A deserted partner is not bound to make war on the deserting unbeliever to get him or her to stay. In other words, Piper thinks Paul is saying, if you have been abandoned by a non-believing partner and the marriage seems to be over, let them go. You are not bound to have to keep trying to pull them back. And the verses following, you're not bound to think that it's your job to see them come to Christ. Let them go, seems to be Paul's injunction at that point. But an interpretation one person would say, not bound in 7:15 does not mean free to remarry. It simply means no longer locked into that first marriage that has been abandoned. But it doesn't mean, according to interpretation one, free to remarry. Why? Well, because he's already ruled out remarriage after divorce back in verse 11. So it would seem odd in verse 15 to suddenly say it's possible, interpretation one goes. And he uses a different word for bound in one context or the other. Now, this is all getting a bit Greeky, and this is the only time we're really going to dig into Greek tonight, so bear with me. But this is the way John Piper describes it. He says the word used for bound, which is doulou in verse 15, isn't the same word used in verse 39 where Paul says a wife is bound deo to her husband as long as he lives. Paul consistently uses deo when speaking of the legal aspect of being bound to one marriage partner or to one's betrothed. But when he refers to a deserted spouse not being bound in 1 Corinthians 7:15, he chooses a different word, doulou. And if this is losing you, here's his point. which we would expect him to do if he were not giving a deserted spouse the same freedom to remarry that he gives to a spouse whose partner has died. That's interpretation one. Sometimes divorce is inevitable, tragically, but remarriage is never permissible. That's the first interpretation of this passage. And in verses 27 to 28, some people say, well, maybe when Paul's talking there, he might be including not just the never married, but the divorced as well. And interpretation one goes, no, he's not, because he's stated already that there's a new section starting in verse 25. He's no longer talking to those who might have been abandoned from a marriage. He's talking to those who've never been married at this point. So it goes like this. Interpretation one, Paul says that divorce is occasionally inevitable, but that remarriage is never permissible. One of the great campaigners for this position is Gordon Fee, who is one of the kind of evangelical heroes when it comes to handling scripture well, and Fee, as is Piper. And Fee says this: there is little question that both Paul and Jesus disallowed divorce between two believers, especially when it served as grounds for remarriage. On the other hand, divorce may happen, but what is not allowed is remarriage. Both because for him that presupposes the teaching of Jesus that such is adultery, and because in the Christian community, reconciliation is the norm. If the Christian husband and wife cannot be reconciled to one another, how then can they expect to become models of reconciliation before a fractured and broken world? That's interpretation one. And interpretation one person would say, it does seem to be a plain reading of the text. If you just read the text and you just have to see what jumps out at you, it would seem to say divorce might be inevitable, but remarriage is not permissible. But there's a second interpretation. We'll zip through this and we're done. This is interpretation two, the other way of viewing 1 Corinthians 7. And it says this: Paul is certainly, first of all, Paul is certainly forbidding, Rabbi Hillel style, any cause, no fault, divorce by separation, just as Jesus did. If you remember Ruth 2 weeks ago, she was addressing this debate there were between two rabbinic schools. And one of them, Hillel, was basically saying, if a wife displeases a husband in any way, shape or form, he's free to go. And Jesus gives that one a right good kicking. And interpretation two says, that's absolutely right. Paul is saying that. So Paul is saying to the non-Christian partner, to the Christian partner with the non-Christian husband or wife who's tempted to leave the marriage just because the partner isn't a Christian, Paul is saying, no, you're married, you stay married, don't leave. If it's up to you, don't leave, he says. A wife must not separate. That's what's going on in verses 10 and 11. But this is the big idea for the second way of interpreting 1 Corinthians 7. And it's been popularized by this guy, who's a Cambridge scholar called David Instone Brewer. He did a whole load of stuff in Cardiff as a pastor for years and years, and now he's working at a theological research institute in Cambridge called Tyndale House. He produced a huge work on divorce and remarriage, and Instone Brewer points this out. And it's about the culture into which this letter was written. And he says this: in the matter of remarriage, the Greco-Roman and Jewish world were very similar to our own. Anyone who had a valid divorce had an automatic right to remarry. In fact, the main purpose of a divorce certificate was to state this right. The only compulsory words on a Jewish get or divorce certificate were, "You are now free to marry any man you wish." Very similar words occurred on most Greco-Roman divorce certificates, though they rarely bothered to even write one. As soon as a couple separated, either partner was free to remarry. And Instone Brewer is going, that's the expectation of the first recipients of this letter. When they read divorce or separation or having been left, that's what they understood. Well, if that was the case, then there was an automatic right to remarry, just inevitably. So interpretation says, two says, Paul is forbidding Rabbi Hillel style, no divorce, no fault divorce, just separate, just as Jesus did. He, of course, he's saying no to that. But because of the historical context, when Paul says a deserted partner is not bound in verse 15, first century readers would assume he was speaking about the freedom to remarry. Do you see his point? He says that's what divorce meant in the first century. It meant a freedom to remarry. And so that would just have been the assumption into which Paul was writing. He goes on to say this. This was as close as Paul got to stating that remarriage is allowed, though his readers didn't really need Paul's permission. Remarriage was such a firmly established right in both Jewish and Greco-Roman law that it would require a very definite statement in the New Testament to convince them otherwise. In fact, it was illegal for a Roman citizen to remain unmarried for more than 18 months after a divorce, though this law was rarely enforced. So Paul would have had to tell Christians to break the law if he'd forbidden marriage. Instone Brewer says, it may not be clear to us from a 21st century perspective, but from a first century perspective, it would have been absolutely clear that somebody who had been abandoned was always free to remarry. And that's what Paul must have meant. William Heth is a very interesting guy on this topic. We've been recommending this book, if you wanted to dig into this deeper, Remarriage and Divorce in Today's Church. And Heth is one of those scholars who's changed his mind in the last few years. For years and years, Heth said, no remarriage after divorce at all. And then lately, he's changed his position slightly. And this is why, this is one of the reasons why, this Instone Brewer insight. And Heth says this, given the reader's assumptions, neither Jesus nor Paul would have had to specify that remarriage is permitted. But a prohibition on remarriage, where valid grounds for divorce are specified in that first century culture, would require greater clarification by the Bible writers. Heth and Instone Brewer are basically saying this. If Jesus and Paul had really meant no remarriage at all after divorce, they would have made it so much clearer. Because for most of their first century listeners, Jewish or Greek or Roman, they would have simply assumed that any divorce meant the right to remarry. So interpretation two would say this. Have you instigated a divorce without due cause? Are you a kind of, I was just tired of my partner kind of divorce, or a they weren't a Christian and I was kind of divorce? Have you instigated a divorce without due cause, without adultery or desertion as the cause for it? Then the advice would be repent and reconcile if possible, or if not, stay single and serve God. But, interpretation of 1 Corinthians 7, the second interpretation would say, are you deserted following another's initiative to divorce you without due cause? What we sometimes call the innocent party. Are you the innocent party in someone else's desertion of you? Or are you the innocent party in an adultery committed against you, according to this interpretation? Then you are free to remarry. And those are the two big interpretations of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And it's one of the key passages on divorce and remarriage in the New Testament. And what we'll be doing over these next few weeks and months, along with the gospel passages that Ruth helped us with a fortnight ago, we're going to be chewing them over as a congregation. And we're going to be looking at these different interpretations. We're going to issue the paper next month that will help you think these thoughts through in a bit more slowly and clearly than we've been able to do tonight. And we would really encourage you to engage with this process. As you will be only too aware, this is not just some kind of dry academic exercise. This is affecting real lives, as Elise was so helpfully reminding us as we prayed earlier on. And we really would commend you to engage with it thoroughly.